Quaker.com podcast. Today with me is a very special guest, William Anderson, Bill Anderson. He is Associate Professor of Economics at Frostburg State University, adjunct scholar at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, and an adjunct at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, formerly Professor of Economics at North Greenville College. Bill, thank you very much for coming on the show with me.
Oh, good to be here.
You have the same problem I have, and you have a very common name, Bill Anderson, William Anderson. The same with my name, Ben Stone. If you Google it, you come up with millions of hits that are not me.
Mm-hmm.
The first two people I thought of when I first saw your name, and I think this was probably around 2000 or so when I first bumped into your work. I thought of the singer Whispering Bill Anderson.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it used to be. That was the famous one.
And the exact opposite, I thought of Bloody Bill Anderson.
He used to have the victims, his victim scalps on his saddle.
Yeah,
that boy played hardball.
Quite a character. And of course, politically, it's according to how you look at, well, I guess, was it Napoleon that said the winners write the history? So, yeah.
Yeah, I know it. Yeah. Right. If the South had won, yeah, Bloody Bill Anderson would have been considered a folk hero, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. The hero of Missouri.
There you go. Yeah.
One of the things that you have really, now you've got a fairly wide palette of things that you write about, but the thing that really fires me up when I read your writing is in reference to prosecutorial and judicial and police misconduct.
Yeah.
You really did a service to those young boys at the at Duke University with the lacrosse team. Can you tell me about your involvement in that?
Yeah, I just, I remember when I first saw the allegations, I thought, having been a collegiate athlete, granted it was 40 years ago, but, I thought, are athletes capable of this? Well, yeah, at least some of my teammates were, but it just didn't make a lot of sense to me. It just that, the more I looked into it, the more I thought this just doesn't make any sense. And when they had the DNA announcement, which, by the way, Nifong, the prosecutor, had that material for 2 weeks before he gave it to the defense, but he would not release, didn't give it to him until after he'd gone on his campaign of vilifying the players. And so by the time they got it, it was just bad spin. But I'll tell you what really, and I wrote it even an article before there were indictments, about it. And there I had the line, evidence. We don't need no stinking evidence. But after Reed Seligman was indicted, a cab driver who had given him a ride that night was interviewed on CNN, and he said, well, I had him picked up, and then they had pictures of Reed at a bank teller, supposedly at a time when he's raping Crystal Mangum. Now, you have to understand the prosecutor refused to look at any of this material beforehand, even though his attorneys tried to give it to him. And so I posted on Lou Rockwell's on the blog that the cab driver now needs to be in fear because they're going to come after him. And I even wrote a letter to one of the attorneys who was representing some of the players at the time, a guy named Bill Thomas. I never heard back from him, but what I said was, that the cab driver is going to be arrested. They'll trump up charges on him to try to get him to change his story. And 3 weeks later, the guy was arrested on trumped up charges of shoplifting. And that was, I thought, okay, that's it. This is, we are now at war. And I, because I had made a prediction, it'd come true. And so now I was pissed. You know, you should, you know, I was hoping that these guys wouldn't, you know, wouldn't meet my expectations, but they met my expectations. And so at that point it was war. And, but you got to remember, Lou gave me a, he gave me a forum for it. And so, yeah, I started, you know, I started bombing away. And, yeah, they all knew me. They hated, you know, the, well, the players and their families liked me, but the other people in Durham hated my guts. they hated me. They'd have killed me if they could have gotten away with it. But it was the here is the way I saw it. It was, okay, guys, you have tried to take the impossible and turn it into something. You've taken forensic material that everybody knows what it is. And these are the journalists too, not to mention the college professors. You've got forensic material here. You know what the science says. You know why the science says it. There are certain things that you look for. That, you know, how do you get rid of DNA? Well, you have to use certain chemicals like bleach. Well, no, none of those chemicals were used. There was no way to get rid of DNA in this in the way that they had claimed. And so what was going on was this was a pure power play by the prosecutor and by his and by the courts of North Carolina. And so I thought, okay, that's it. I was already upset with him because in the early 90s, they had railroaded a bunch of people into prison for false child molestation in the Little Rascals case. So I thought, all right, you know, I didn't have a forum back then. I was doing some writing for a magazine, but the editor said he didn't want to look like he supported child molestation. So,
wow.
Yeah, and so I didn't, back then I didn't have a forum. I always vowed if I ever have a forum, you know, if I ever and something like this happens, I am going to war. And so I went to war. And, and the thing was, I mean, it wasn't hard to find information. This isn't, you know, no matter what the Duke president says, well, the facts kept changing every day. That's just nonsense. I mean, sheer nonsense. Facts were always what they were. All it took was just a little, just a little bit of common sense, literally the ability to add 1 + 2 + 3. I'm not trying to be facetious here. It was that easy. And it's just that America now is so politicized, and especially college campuses are so politicized, and journalism is so politicized that literally the political narratives won out over the scientific narratives. That's really what was going on. But anyway, going back to it, I tend to try to avoid political narratives when they override, when they're obviously going to override the truth. And I do not, I think that one of the worst things that's happening in this country is that, you know, everything gets politicized, and that's what happened at the LaCrosse case. It was just politicized. And so the other thing is that the court systems operate as though the prosecutors, you know, in North Carolina, elsewhere, as though the prosecutors are honest people. And so when you have people like Mike Nifong who are, Nifong's always been, you know, a jerk, and he's always been dishonest. I mean, you know, the man's a born liar. He's always been that way. And prosecution was a perfect, you know, profession for him to get into. Mm-hmm. So, and he's a bully too. I mean, so yeah, it's great for him to be in that.
That's, you know, this is something I've talked about lately. That's a case, I think, of self-selection bias. Yeah, where
indeed, that's exactly the term to use. It's a self-selection. When you have a situation that in which people are not held accountable, the worst not only get on top, but you also have a situation in which people who are honest tend to be driven out over time.
Exactly. I've talked quite a bit about that lately, actually, even this earlier than this week, that that's one of the major problems with almost any aspect of a government, you know, some government agency like that.
Yeah, I would call unregulated government.
Yeah. Now, and in case somebody's listening or in case somebody just tuned in on the radio and they don't know what we're talking about, the Duke University lacrosse team members were falsely accused of raping a disgruntled exotic dancer, shall we say.
Called a stripper.
Okay.
She basically was just a prostitute. And you got to understand the way that, you know, I don't know anything about the world of strippers. That was one of the things I came to learn. But what happens is that stripping is sort of a front for prostitution. And so what they'll do is they'll go to a party or something like that. And if it's obvious that they're not going to get the business that they came for, and that is, you know, sex, that what they'll do is they'll stage some sort of scene and leave, okay? Because I think this particular case, they got paid $400 a piece. And so, you know, these ladies are used to making a lot of money by the hour. And so that's, you know, which is how, you know, how they made money. And in the media, what they wanted to do is portray, you know, these women as, you know, oh, well, just because he's a prostitute doesn't mean this or that. Well, nonetheless, I mean, the business of prostitution is the business of prostitution. You have to understand how it works. And they were not willing to do that. They wanted, you know, which is why they referred to it as an exotic dancer. What the heck is that? It's stripping.
And not, I don't mean to embarrass you here, but your work literally saved those boys. It literally gave them a future.
Well, yeah, that I think that and some good attorneys and Casey Johnson with his blog Durham and Wonderland, and also Stuart Taylor at the National Journal. Those guys, Stuart used to write for the Times, and they really they stepped up to the plate. They had really, those guys had awfully good contacts. Their contacts actually were better than mine with the insiders, because they had contacts with the attorneys. The attorneys didn't. The only attorney I had contact with was suddenly his name escapes me. Kirk Osborne, and he died in March of 2007 of a massive heart attack. Kirk and I did have contact, although I would not discuss the case with him. I kept some distance, because what you don't want to do is, you know, the attorneys cannot be seen as teaming up with somebody on the outside who, you know, is calling everybody, you know, the judges and prosecutors, and they're a bunch of liars. You can't, I mean, you know, they're officers of the court, and they can't do that. It's like, I don't know if you ever saw my blog post on the Tanya Kraft trial a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a gag order, but I had no contact with the defense at all. I had contact with one woman who had ties to the defense and ties to Tanya, but I didn't have anything at all with the attorneys. And so when the DA alleged that I was part of the defense strategy there, that he was just lying. I mean, there wasn't any, you know, defense didn't know. They didn't know who the heck I was. I mean, nobody, well, I'd say people in North Georgia knew who I was, because I taught school there. I grew up there. But, you know, it had been a long time ago. But still, that was a... so you have to be careful. But the one nice thing about when you're working independently is that you can say what you want, you know, and as long as Lou is willing to print it, hey, you know, it was good luck.
Now, on a more recent article, actually, you did it just here recently, the other day, You were talking about the Supreme Court's ruling on judge and prosecutor misconduct.
Yeah, and it was on the Shalom Rabashkin case, and that's a very polarizing case, to be honest, because he was a Hasidic Jew, and he had a plant in Pottsville, Iowa, and this plant made it was a slaughterhouse for kosher meats, all right, and that was his main set of customers. You know, were the markets that served Jewish customers, and specifically Orthodox Jewish customers, people who kept kosher, And from what I understand, he wasn't a real good businessman. He was sort of a warm-hearted guy and all that. Now, they hired a lot of illegal aliens, but there wasn't any real, you know, he wasn't known for mistreating people or anything like that. He was, you know, but nonetheless, Hasidic Jews generally, you know, the Gentile community would look on them with kind of, you know, a certain amount of trepidation or whatever, because they don't have a lot of contacts with Gentiles, and so they're seen as being, you know, stricter and whatnot. And if you've ever read Chaim Potok's book, The Chosen, or you've seen the movie that was based on it, you know, you get a sense more of Hasidim and the like. It's not a rabbit trail. It's important. But the point is that you're going to have some separation from your community. On top of that, they had a lot of people from Mexico and Central America working there. And so, you know, and the guy sort of kept the business together. And so they had a raid, what was in the, I guess, their version of the INS, and I don't even know what they call it now. But the Immigration Service, and they had a raid, and a judge, Linda Reed, a federal judge, worked behind the scenes with the these agents and FBI and all these folks to help them coordinate and the thing, and she wanted to be kept abreast of it and all that. Okay, this is a judge who's later going to hear a criminal case against the man, basically participating in the early investigating steps. This is not a good thing. And so they had they raided the place, filed a bunch of counts. I think they were state counts, and he was acquitted of everything regarding immigration. Okay, now this is important that the feds never brought immigration charges, because what they did, they shut down the business. All right, by the raid. Okay, now he can't pay his bills. Now you go bankrupt, and also, now the banks that he owed money to, you know, one specific bank in I think it was in St. Louis, because all of a sudden he can't pay them. I think they either went belly up or they had some severe problems. I think either went into receivership or close to it. Okay, and so what they alleged was that he had overestimated the value of his assets. And so they charged him with 89 counts or more of bank fraud. And I forget what else they charged him, but it was basically bank fraud. And
So basically they destroyed his business, and then they accused him of overestimating the value of his business.
Yeah, and on top of that, you know, then they said, well, this is a, you know, $400 million bank fraud. Well, no, I mean, in other words, the value of the business or the value of the loan or whatever, how much he owed. But that's not this. When you destroy somebody's business and they can't pay it back, you don't say the entire thing is fraudulent. All right. And they also went after him on a very obscure law, Packers and something Meat Producers Act of 1921. Never before had this law been used in a criminal case. They went after him on that as well. And the judge, he was tried, I think, in South Dakota. The judge was Linda Reed. All right. And she pretty much rigs a trial. And this is where also, but I will also say that Americans really are making lousy and lousier jurors, especially in federal courts. It's very, very rare in federal court that a juror will actually take a hard look at what the prosecution is doing. And I have seen some acquittals. I did a lot of writing or someone on the one a couple years ago, the Bear Stearns case, in which Ralph Chiaffi and Michael Tannen were acquitted in federal court in Brooklyn. The feds brought the case to Brooklyn because they thought the Brooklyn jury might be dumber and they might just get incensed. It's a couple rich guys are on trial. And they pretty well showed that the feds had nothing. Then afterwards, the feds claimed that, well, the Brooklyn jury is too stupid to understand the intricacies of finance. I had fun with that one. But I've kept in touch with Ralph Chiaffi ever since. He was a good man. But anyway, on this particular case, the one in Iowa, you've got the judge pushing the jurors, and what jurors don't understand is that if you actually were to use the criteria that the feds used for criminal charges, you'd have to lock up almost all the meat packers in this country. You would have to lock up anybody who gets business loans. You would have definitely locked up all of Wall Street, you know, for the with the meltdown, because what do you think they're doing with these mortgage certificates? And of course, you'd have to lock up Ben Bernanke for, you know, paying fraudulent amounts for these housing mortgage securities that aren't worth squatola, and he's paying close to full price for them. You know, the Fed holding them, that's okay. Why is that not? You know, I mean, that's the same thing. It's the same darn thing. And yet, you know, and so, but it looks bad. And you can take, I mean, if, you know, I've gone round and round with people about this. And he said, but look at the evidence against them. And, you know, I'm like, if this were something, if these were actual crimes and they were serious crimes, and why aren't more people who actually openly do this stuff, why aren't they put on trial? Why aren't they convicted? Well, the main reason was that, you know, Rubashkin did not have a good political constituency behind him. And one of the things was also see some of the Jewish publications. There are a lot of splits within the Jewish community, as you know. And I think the Forward was after him all the time. You know, PETA went after him and all that. And so you have a lot of this, you know, this background dynamic at work. All right. Now, the problem, you know, that in the appeal, they centered it around the judge. Okay. This judge should have recused herself. And in fact, what happened was the prosecutors first wanted to give him life in prison. And then there was a big storm raised by a lot of former people from the Justice Department, people that's actually served as, you know, prosecutors and whatnot, and they're going, this is ridiculous. And these were some of the prominent people. And so the prosecutors came back and said, well, we would just want 25 years. Linda Reed gave him 27 years, which essentially is a life sentence. The guy's about my age. I think a little bit younger than I am. But, you know, we're talking about that the way that it would work. I mean, he would not get out of jail until he's about 75, chances are he'd die in prison. I mean,
wow.
And so that's the, yeah. And so, and the Supreme Court refused to hear it. The appeals courts have just so, you know, it bothers me because nobody will address some of the real issues here. And that, you know, and we have huge amounts of selective law enforcement, selective prosecution. If they're going to go after this man, then they need to go after every meat packer in the United States, because everybody in that business has violated the Meat Packers, you know, Act of 1921. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're dealing with some things. And so here's the other thing. We're talking about time, you know, we're laws that have arbitrary numbers. I was talking about to my wife about this, you know, that we have, you know, like for also you have 10 day, we have the number 10, 1 year, you know, all of these are numbers that are put down. And if you go past a certain thing by even a minute, it's a felony. Well, I mean, why is that extra minute? What's so important about that extra minute? Well, you broke a rule. All right. So what happens is you end up, you have to under, and I just sent an article off. I have no idea if the person's going to accept it or not, called A Nation of Bureaucrats. And what I said was United States, once known for rule of law, now is known for rule of rules. And that's what you have. And in a case like this, I mean, Rubashkin violated some rules, but he wasn't trying to defraud anybody. The bank understood, the people in the bank, and they know that. It's like, oh, let me give you an example, okay? During the housing boom, the bank would send an appraiser, and the appraiser would say, the appraiser would appraise the property at some high amount because the bank wanted to be able to make the loan. All right. Who was committing the fraud? In fact, I had a situation, I was refinancing our house several years ago, and the appraiser asked me three times, do you think this house is worth $240,000? And I said to him, that is not for me to say. I am not going to tell you what I think it should be appraised at. Three times, and I can't help, you know, and I'm not a particularly paranoid person, but I can't help but wonder if, you know, somebody's trying to set me up. But nonetheless, I thought, well, I remember thinking to myself, if I say yes, does that make me guilty of mortgage fraud? And
yeah.
I could be put on trial for mortgage fraud. And I guarantee a jury convict me because they would be told, you know, that, hey, rules are rules. I mean,
yeah.
And so I just, you know, and he, I think he praised it at 235. But I mean, I was not going, you know, to me, I mean, it was an integrity issue, but also it was an issue in which it's not my place. You know, I'm not going to tell somebody, oh, I want you to value it at this. I'm not going to do that. All right. But it's done a lot in banking. I mean, if you really are going to apply the standard to put Shalom Rubashkin in prison, you would have to imprison a huge portion of our population. Are you willing to do that? If you're not, then don't engage in selective prosecution. And don't say rules are rules. Look, ask yourself, what's about these rules that are so ridiculous?
This reminds me, and we've talked about this earlier, this reminds me of Harvey Silvergate's great book, Three Felons a Day. And he basically says in there that really, if they want you, they can find something to get you on. If you come under their radar, they'll have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's exactly right. And Harvey actually sent me the pre-publication copy. That's the one I have, you know, and which is why what copy I have doesn't look like the one, at least on the outside, that you might have seen. But Three Felonies a Day clearly lays out what is going on and it's dedicated to the federal courts and how the federal system works. And I will also say Harvey's been a mentor of mine for years, and Harvey and I have traded ideas. He has, and I'm talking about for about a decade now. And he has been mentoring me, and we have a lot of correspondence. It's email or through Facebook, and so if there's a legal question, I generally will run it before him because I have that. I trust his judgment. And by the way, Harvey is not a everybody is innocent, you know, guy. That's not his point. His point is, though, what do we mean by rule of law? How do we what kind of law should we have? How far should prosecution go? And he believes it's, and rightly so, I think that it's gone way too far. And you know, he's also a man with great integrity. I mean, nobody ever questions Harvey's integrity. I mean, it's not done. I have never seen anybody do it. I'm sure maybe some, you know, prosecutors in private have called them, you know, complained about it. But I'm talking about in the people who actually have real dealings with the man. Nobody mm-hmm. I've never seen anyone publicly even begin to claim that the man doesn't have integrity. And I think it begins there, you know, that you have to have that. And we're seeing in with prosecutors that they're drawing people in as ADAs and people who want to be career prosecutors who are not people with a conscience. Maybe some of them are. Maybe some of them come in because, by George, they want to take a bite out of crime and they want to. And what happens over time is that you lose that ability to discern between, you know, a person who's guilty and a person who's not. A friend of mine told me, she said that after a while that it was the old, you know, I was a hammer and everybody else was a nail. She said, and I had to get out. You know, she just did not want to have to deal with that.
I've often said that I've compared the D.C. government as it exists today. And I asked the question to people, what's different about the D.C. government today and the post-Stalin Soviet government at any particular time?
Well, hell, pre-Soviet government, for that matter. I don't think there's any appreciable difference. The only difference is that D.C. and our central government does not have an official guiding ideology other than Americanism like they had, you know, with Marxist-Leninism. And there is still some private ownership of things. And also that we do have, at least within our history, things like free speech. We still have expectations that people are going to act a certain way. And so that keeps us from going over that edge that was the Soviet Union. And I mean, the Soviet Union was awful. But, you know, I think that the sad thing is, though, that at least the people in that system toward the end of the USSR really were understanding that the thing was a big lie. And they were and people were asking them things like, you know, why are we putting up with this? What, you know, why do we have to live like this? Why can't we be free to travel? Explain to me why we have to have all these restrictions. And finally, they just, it's like, I remember East Germany. Well, I don't know why we have to do this. What's the point? You know, what's the point of locking everybody up? It doesn't make sense. And finally, when the people in charge said, what the heck, you know, then, you know, the gates were thrown open. But in this country, we've been going the other way. And we, you know, since 9/11, especially, national security, terrorism, we have to protect ourselves. You know, if you see something, say something. And so we've been going the other way. And plus the fact that for 100 years we've had as a sort of this Americanism, American progressivism, I would call it, in which it's a kind of a quasi-religious belief in America. You know, if you notice Romney's campaign slogan, believe in America. But you've got this progressivism, which basically says that progress comes through expansion of the state. And the application of the work of experts working, you know, for the state. And so you've got, you know, we've had that guiding ideology. And so the irony is places like China and Russia become freer and people start having expectations of, you know, of freedom, whereas we don't anymore. We, you know, look at, you know, what's happened to free speech. Great Britain the same way. That people go to prison now for, quote, hate speech. And it's the government decides what hate speech is. So, you've got that whole progressive mentality going on that's really, frankly, it's frightening.
Let me shift gears just slightly and ask you, what do you think causes the government, and I kind of know how you're going to answer this, but what do you think causes the government to continue this silly war on drugs? What do you think the motivation there is?
Well, there are two or three things. On one side, you have a lot of people who are self-interested. It's what you would call the Baptists and the bootleggers. Have you ever heard of that theory of regulation?
Oh, yeah.
All right, yeah. It was actually started up by my old buddy, Bruce Yandel, Clemson University. Mm-hmm. Bruce has also been a mentor to me for, 30 years.
Yeah, I was just talking about that the other day on my podcast.
Well, and so who are the bootleggers? You know, well, okay, for those... So let's, you know, in any type of situation like that, you're going to have, you look for your Baptists and your bootleggers. And okay, so the bootleggers are going to be the people in law enforcement, the people who make a living from enforcing the drug war, right? And also, frankly, the politicians, because politicians benefit as well. I mean, they look tough on drugs. And so you have a lot of people. Now, understand something, that the drug war does not produce wealth. It destroys wealth. It's a wealth consumer, but you have a large number of people making a living from it who are then able, and so they're able to consume from their role in the drug war. All right. So it's, you know, if all of a sudden you ended the drug war, there would be a lot of people out of work.
Yeah, not only drug dealers and that kind of thing, but, you know, the people that sell, you know, bullet-resistant vests.
Oh, yeah.
All the way to the guys that wear
them.
Oh,
absolutely, yeah. And you're right. And drug dealers would be part of that. And I apologize for not pointing that out. You're absolutely right. The drug dealers, the guys who are making the big bucks right now, they definitely would be... part of that bootlegging thing, because once it became legitimized, I mean, everything would change. I mean, one thing is that you could, you know, you wouldn't have to settle disputes with violence. You could let lawyers do it. It'd be great if some of these lawyers could shoot each other. But nonetheless, that's on the Baptist side. Where you have, other than Baptists, real live Baptists, I mean, you have the people who, well, drugs are bad. You shouldn't be taking drugs. We need to stop people from taking drugs. So we have, if you are, in fact, somebody who is advocating into the drug war and saying, hey, people ought to be able to put in their bodies what they want, you know, you want to give drugs to children. You want, I've heard the lines.
Yeah, it's crazy that they make that leap. I think it's like Bastiat was talking about how if you say we don't want the government to provide, X, then that doesn't mean we're against X. We just don't want the government to provide it. But they make that leap.
Yeah, you're right, Ben. I mean, they do make that leap, and that way you don't have to engage in serious argument, because now you've demonized your opponent wants people to suffer. Your opponent wants people to be spaced out. Your opponent wants women to have meth mouth and the like. So I think that you end up with that kind of a situation. And these folks make political alliance, and you know, it's a kind of a god on our side, you know, because who can be for drugs? Who can be for, you know, children are getting strung out in school and all that? So if you're for this, you know, if you think it's bad, then it should be illegal. It just logically follows. And so, and I think also there's that utopianism that comes with progressivism, that we're here to build a certain kind of society. We won't stop until you're not going to have utopia. I mean, you have to understand that people are going to do things that are, you know, maybe even harmful to their bodies. But, I mean, for that matter, let's look at, you want to talk about drug abuse, fine. Let's look at professional football and all these guys coming out of there with concussions and brain damage. And, you know, a man like Junior Seau, killing himself. I mean, would, let's just say that he had never, this man had never touched football in his life, never played football. Do you think he would have been taking his life? No, probably not. And yet, I mean, you have governments spending big bucks to build stadiums, and you have all sorts of money going into professional football. So let's, you know, that, and yet what's going on out there is bad for their health. I mean, linemen, offensive and defensive linemen, I think in pro football have a very short life expectancy. And so what are we going to say about that? We're going to say, well, this is terrible. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. Let's make it illegal. Let's see, you know, how we far go with that one.
Actually, I think some of the liberals would be, some of the more progressives would be more than happy to jump right on that bandwagon.
I mean, there are, oh, believe me, I mean, there are people who, you know, ban everything, and they, you know, it's, and you end up with this alliance, especially in something like the drug war, between the liberals and the, you know, hard right conservatives, the religious right, and they supposedly are big enemies, but both of them end up supporting it, or some sort of public health sort of thing, some sort of coercion in the name of public health. And but here's the thing, that once you accept a view that government should be a major broker in determining what's good for us and what is not good for us, once somebody accepts that, then there really is no limit to what government should be able to do. If you make the assessment that government maybe should not be doing this, then you are really put off. By the way, you're being put in a category. If you're, you know, that you're a nut job, whack job, nut case, that sort of thing. So,
you just want chaos.
Yeah, you're right. Want chaos. You want people. You want people to die. You want, you know, this and that. And so it's like I was reading in a book. Ron Paul would just allow bad places like North Korea to exist. Well, guess what? You know, North Korea exists, and it's going to exist. You know, it's everything to do with Roosevelt and Stalin's behind all during World War II.
We can you hear me, Bill?
Oh, yeah, sure can.
We just lost connection momentarily there, and I lost all that.
Yeah, we're yeah. I think I got a feeling the connection problems in our end. We've had a lot of network trouble on campus today, and I had not gotten on until just about 10, 15 minutes before you called.
I wanted to ask you about the adoption process and if it was smooth or rough, and if you suggest it to other people, that kind of thing.
Good question. For people who don't know me at all, I have four adopted children. Now, I actually have five altogether, but my oldest is 35 per child. But she's doing quite well, despite the fact of, you know, the overall man. But I have the two boys who are Ethiopians, and they're officially 16 and 17. We don't know their real birthdays. But then we have a girl from Guatemala who's 13. And another daughter from Latvia who will be 14. Let me see, next week. Yeah, a week from Thursday. And in the order of adoption, the girl from Guatemala, we actually got the youngest. We got first. We got her in March of 2000. The boys came October 1st of 2001. And Cynthia, the Latvian, she came to us last year, first through a hosting program, and stayed with us, and so I think July 10th of 2011. It's not an easy process. It's at all. I mean, it's very, very expensive. I'll literally work, you know, until I probably get booted out or dragged out, because, you know, just of all the expenses going on. You know, I'll be 59 in a month, and you know, and everything that I had went into these adoptions, and so, you know, I certainly, you know, I would not recommend doing it without understanding what it is you're going to have to do. So yeah, it's expensive. Here is the other thing, and that we did, by the way. Somebody will say, well, why didn't you go through the U.S. system? Well, we did. We tried to go through the U.S. system for years. All right. And the U.S. system is so bad that, it is a crapshoot. It's hit and miss. The other thing, we did not want to run into a situation where all of a sudden, a couple years down the road, you've got a birth parent suddenly demanding their child. And that does happen. And the courts will give it back. I mean, courts, pretty uniform.
Yeah, they do.
And so trying to get an older child, my gosh, I mean, just the hoops that you jump through. And we had one where we it was in 2008. I think we made about five or six trips to New York City in a few months. I mean, it cost a lot of money. The last one was just before the night before that big, huge snowstorm hit the East Coast. The rock was constantly tumbling back to the bottom of the hill. You'd push that thing up your nose, and you get near the top, and bureaucrats would do something, and the child care bureaucracy in this country is. The foster system is not very good, and it's never going to be very good. But that's one reason why people will tend to go overseas, because there's a little more certainty in the process. Now, I will say this. This is a problem that you're going to have with adopting children. That's the issue of what you call attachment. Unless you can get a baby right, so a child right at birth or whatever, that, our youngest, we didn't get her until she was almost 8 months old. And there's a very important process that goes on in those early months, but being able to bond, and there just wasn't any bonding there. And the girl from Latvia has been in orphan care since she was 8 months old. I'm literally the first man in her life that isn't an alcoholic or just, some sort of abusive, person. And the boys, they went through real trauma, real life trauma, in their own situations. And so all that does psychological damage. So we've had, it has not been an easy process bringing them up. And, right now I've got four teenagers in the house, and on top of all the other issues that you have with adoption, we also have the regular issues of teenagers being teenagers. The girl from Latvia also has fetal alcohol syndrome, which has really delayed a lot of her development. Good kid. I mean, she's a really sweet kid and all. We don't know what her future is going to be. And that's just one of the things you do, though. I mean, if you go through this process, you have to understand that. The kids are not going to say, oh, thank you for rescuing me or something like that. They're not going to do that. They're going to be kids, and they're going to be teenagers. It's a time of your life, when you're just so utterly self-centered, bad enough with being a birth child.
Well, I still think it's heroic on your part to take on the challenge
that. Yeah, thank you. I think maybe nuts would be, but I mean, I will say this. I don't regret it. I don't look back on it and say, oh, I shouldn't have done it. I mean, it's tough. It is. And this last month has been really, really tough. I've always felt like we've done the right thing. And, and to me, that you really do have to. I believe, our family were Christians. We believe in that there's accountability. There's real life judgment down the road, and there's real life accountability. And a lot of things that go on now that just don't make sense, that they can make sense later. But, I don't sit around and pine all the lost opportunities that I had, whatnot. A lot of stuff. I don't get to take cruises and things like that, but so what? I mean, it's not like I'm, I haven't lost sleep over, oh, I can't take cruises. Well, so what? Get over it. I just see a bunch of fat people, drinking away the cruise.
Now, you're also a music fan.
Yeah.
Tell my listeners what kind of music you like.
Yeah, all of the above. Actually, I like there are two things. I'm in the Cumberland Choral Society, and actually my favorite is what we would call early music to Renaissance. And I actually like the period instruments. 6 years ago, I started taking violin lessons. I'm actually thinking next term, in the spring, you know, in the fall, we do a Christmas concert. I always like that. But we're doing Carmina Burana next. And I've done it before, and it's not, some people love it. I'm not one of them. It's just okay. So I'm thinking about, you know, joining the local orchestra, you know, to get in the second violin section. You know, if you figure that a person, you know, my age, you always want to have challenges, but, it would be in straight classical music. I like Scottish fiddling, Irish fiddling, and I've done a fair amount of just solo work singing. So, I mean, I've, you know, been involved in that way. I don't have much of a formal music background. Obviously, I read music and all, but not a real formal music. But I was real fortunate in Chattanooga when I lived there. I was in the Bach choir, and that was a really good select choir. We had some awfully good voices there, and so that was a real privilege. I mean, I always enjoyed that, but I was in the Choral Arts Society, which was good, but the Bach choir really, to me, was kind of my ultimate musical experience.
Now, I'm shooting in the dark here because I actually don't know this at all, but I'm kind of assuming some things here that perhaps you have some traditional Appalachian culture in your background, or at least Scotch-Irish?
I've got on my grandfather's side, my mother's side, her grandfather, on you know, her father's father, was a Scot, off the boat Scot, and I think grandmother was too. And so so we've got some of that, but on my father's side, they were just all a bunch of Swedes, and out of Chicago, which meant I had to be cursed with being a Cubs fan, and you know, a lifelong curse that you bear. But not really. I mean, I like it. I mean, there are the times, kind of ironic here, you know, I play on Sunday morning, I play hymns Sunday morning, and while we're talking, the Sunday hymns just been emailed to me, so I get to practice them this week. But if you go into even early music, folk music, whatnot, I mean, you're going to find the ties to Appalachian. For that matter, when I was in Latvia, I was really fascinated by a lot of the Latvian folk music, which was closer to Scandinavian, but also kind of a combination of the Baltics of Scandinavian and, of Scandinavian and also of Eastern Europe. And the music, of course, I love when we were adopting Cynthia, we spent nearly a month in Latvia, and I love the music scene there because they did everything from rock and roll to a really good choral stuff. I mean, it's a country with a great musical tradition and great musicians. I mean, the street musicians were orchestra quality for that matter. But I'm always fascinated by the roots of something. And, you know, Appalachian music, of course, really has what they would call the Scotch-Irish roots. And you know, you find a lot of similarities. So, you know, that part's fun.
Well, I suppose we've hit an hour, and I suppose we ought to wrap this up. I would like to impose on you to talk to me for two or three more hours, but you know, we do have the limitations. I certainly want to thank you for coming on the show with me and for taking the time and everything.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. I think like a lot of Americans, I'm concerned about what's going on. And it's not like you can just fight it and change it and whatnot, but you can speak out. I mean, and I know speaking out places pressures on you. I mean, it makes you vulnerable. I mean, it makes you a target. My thing is, well, what I do is then operate as much in the open as possible. So if somebody wants to, come after me, at least we'll know why they're coming after me.
Exactly. Is there any website or projects, books, or anything you'd like to plug before we break off?
I've got my website, the WilliamLAnderson.blogspot.com, and also I have another site, Krugman in Wonderland. It deals with Paul Krugman stuff. It's just kind of more economics and, Austrian economics. And then, there's stuff I have on Lou Rockwell's page and elsewhere. So, I get around a little bit, not as much as maybe I should, but I try to. But yeah, just Google William L. Anderson and you'll find a lot of different sites.
Well, again, I appreciate you coming on the podcast. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thank you.
And it's been wonderful speaking to
you.
All
right, you take care.
Thanks a lot.